Welcome everyone to the First Assist GU Oncology Unpacked podcast. A bit of a mouthful, First Assist for short. I'm your host, Taylor Goodstein, and I'm very, very happy to introduce my guest today, Dr. Eric Singer, who is the chief of the Division of Urologic Oncology at the James Comprehensive Cancer Center and the program director for the SUO Fellowship at The Ohio State University. Hello, Dr. Singer. Thank you so much for being here.
Great to see you. Thank you, Dr. Goodstein, for the invitation. Excited to be on this august podcast. Great work.
I should probably also put out there that Dr. Singer is one of my mentors and readily agreed to help me with this episode because we've actually had this conversation before. So today we're going to be talking about the evolution of advanced kidney cancer treatment. And as I told you, Dr. Singer, I think it's really hard for people coming into oncology today to kind of understand like what's going on. So it's my goal to kind of put the historic context here on the podcast so somebody could listen and kind of know where we started so they can understand kind of like the current trials that are happening in kidney cancer. And you and I, you know, you asked me to do a review paper, I think, during my PGY4. And I came to you like being that person. Like I had no idea what I was doing and you kind of sat me down and explained everything. So where in your mind does the story of kidney cancer kind of begin when we're talking about these advanced treatments?
Well, I guess I'll put it slightly, I'll answer your question slightly differently. Sort of when I got really interested in kidney cancer as something that I wanted to sort of build my career around was seeing sort of the papers that showed cytoreduction plus systemic therapy with interferon were able to make a difference. And I thought that was just fantastic. I remember procrastinating in medical school. So this was, you know, 2001, 2000, 2001. And Dr. Flanagan at Loyola, as well as the EORTC group in Europe, they did their independent papers and then they did a pooled analysis. And I just thought that was really neat. I'm like, so, you know, I knew I was interested in surgery. I was more and more interested in oncology. Mm-hmm. I had not quite found urology and neurologic oncology as a home, but was, you know, being introduced to it by classmates who were a year ahead of me. And I just saw that and said, this is really neat. We're doing complex surgery on patients who have really serious problems and we're able to have surgeons playing a definitive role in their therapy and then also providing additional benefit with systemic therapy. So I think sort of the question is, you know, where does the story of kidney cancer really begin? And it really begins with the immune system. Back then, when we were talking about interferon and then interleukin-2 as, you know, what I originally thought was sort of the immune system era of kidney cancer therapy, but now is sort of referred to as the cytokine era. And then, you know, we've sort of come full circle in a short period of time where we're now very much again using the immune system to very much guide our therapies. So I would say thinking about the immune system and cytokines with interferon and then high dose IL-2 as being sort of the building blocks, the foundational building blocks, but that surgery was always a critical part of those therapies from the beginning.
Right. And those trials that were done looking at cytoreductive nephrectomy and interferon alpha showed a benefit to cytoreductive nephrectomy. And we'll talk a little bit about this as we go through the history, but like the role of cytoreductive nephrectomy has indeed been called into question and is very much kind of an open topic in the modern era. But you're right. It's interesting that like we started with immune therapy, kind of had a little brief foray into targeted therapy and then found our way back to immune therapy. So what was it about kidney cancer that made people think initially that these immune therapies would work for them? Why did they try interferon and IL-2 in the first place?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, they had tried a lot of other things and cytotoxic chemotherapy was not really very successful. Radiation therapy at that time was not felt to be very successful. We do know that kidney cancer can be treated with radiotherapy now, but the way it was being given then, I don't think they had great success. So sort of looking for different things, you know, you would see patients with large tumors and they would have sort of systemic symptoms from it. And I think people were recognizing that there was something being secreted from the tumors that was changing the patient's, you know,
interesting,
more than just microenvironment, but sort of impacting them systemically. And so the idea is, you know, if we could take that big tumor and all the badness that it's secreting and potentially treat it with something else that was showing some anti-cancer effects, as, you know, interferon and the IL-2s were showing, seemed like a logical attempt to do. There were also sort of the rare historical examples of people, you know, having metastatic disease. Most often it would be like a lung nodule where they would have surgery and then that lung nodule would regress in some patients. And so, again, there is an idea that the tumor was exerting effects on the body beyond just the mass effect of where it's located in the retroperitoneum, but there was something going on broader than that. And so I think, you know, these really smart investigators were wise enough and curious enough to look into that and really helped us in our road to where we are now.
Yeah, I remember even in med school learning that RCC was a very paraneoplastic tumor. So it's interesting to hear that that nature of the tumor is what, you know, kind of jump-started the thinking that harnessing the immune system might be helpful for treating it. So in 1992, we get IL-2. What's good about IL-2? What's bad about IL-2?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't say good and bad, but I'd say, you know, what are the strengths and limitations? So at that time, best in class, so up to somewhere around 7% of people would have a complete response. So 7%, not a huge number, but better than what we had up till then. The limitations with IL-2 is very toxic.
Okay.
And so oftentimes patients would need to be treated in an intensive care unit. There was a lot of systemic effects that went on, just capillary leak. So vascular leaking fluids all over the place. They'd need an intense resuscitation. There would sometimes be CNS effects with it, people needing potentially dialysis, pressors. It was a very complex therapy to give. And unfortunately, people died from it. So you had a 7% chance of a complete response, but there was a non-zero chance that this therapy could actually result in mortality.
Uh-huh.
So again, certainly, you know, the folks like Dr. Rosenberg at the NCI, who did some really great work starting with IL-2 and then being able to continue to explore TILs and different immune-based therapies. But, you know, immunotherapy or IL-2 therapy was great, and that it really brought us a next step that you alluded to. Because of the complexity of the therapy, because of the toxicity and the difficulty in giving it, it was sort of quickly transitioned to the targeted therapy era once those drugs became available, predominantly oral drugs, so things that people can now take as an outpatient at home rather than needing to be admitted and potentially intensive care to get therapy. The downside, of course, with that transition to TKIs is, you know, none of them were able to give a 7% complete response rate. So a lot of times it's like, okay, what are we going for here? Is this someone who could potentially tolerate the burdens of therapy in the effort to achieve a rare complete response? Or is this person not going to be best served by the burden of high dose IL-2, and we may want to think about using, you know, one of our oral agents? And we had a rapid proliferation in oral drugs, as you know, starting with sunitinib and sorafenib. At that point, I was now a resident in urology, so firmly entrenched in urology with a deep commitment to urologic oncology. And remember reading those pivotal papers when they came out, bringing us to the TKI era.
Yeah. And I just want to pause and just highlight that the IL-2 really captures this theme, this kind of age-old question in oncology of like, is my treatment going to be worse than the cancer? And I think that's still a problem. I mean, it's still a modern problem, less so than it was back then. But it's always an important question that oncologists, neurologic oncologists are asking themselves. And it sounds like IL-2, for the most part, was almost like too extreme to be worth it for the vast majority of patients. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah. Again, you're looking at a very fit population who would be needed to be selected for IL-2.
Okay.
So remember the demographics of kidney cancer, tends to skew a bit older. You start getting patients who have other comorbidities. You can quickly find yourself that, hey, maybe this isn't the best therapeutic option. And when we only had IL-2, of course, that is a challenge. But once we saw that there were other things available, that there was certainly an opportunity to look at that. And Dr. Allard, who was a fellow at the Brigham, we collaborated on a paper a number of years ago, essentially showing that. TKI use went up quickly and IL-2 use went down precipitously as you had these options. Remember that often when we're writing clinical trials for systemic therapies, we're able to choose our patient population very carefully,
right?
Our inclusion and exclusion criteria. So we tend to pick a healthier population, fewer comorbidities. And then once something's approved, we're now faced with real-world problems and real-world patients. And so something that may have been tested in one group of patients, your table one, the table one in the real world may look a little bit different. And so you are now saying, all right, I've got people who are older or sicker or having other issues. How am I going to take the therapies that we have approved and try to translate both their efficacy and their burden to the patients that come in and see us every day, who aren't sort of pre-selected to meet some of these criteria. So not surprisingly, you can sometimes see some increased toxicity. You can sometimes see some decreased efficacy. But again, it's the struggle of the internal validity versus external validity of the trial that you're setting up.
Before we jump into talking about the TKIs, I just wanted to briefly talk about interferon alpha, which was around the same time as IL-2, but was kind of used off label. Did that have something to do with the toxicity of IL-2?
Yeah, I think the interferon was just, again, another, they're both in, I would put it in the cytokine category. So I think the interferon was, again, thought to be going to be effective and certainly showed that there was some efficacy, but was a, somewhat more tolerable regimen. But again, didn't have the efficacy that the IL-2 did.
Right.
So again, there were all, yeah. So I think, again, it was sort of people were looking, in really actively exploring the cytokine space. And these were two different options that they had at the time.
So that's the 90s. IL-2 is approved in 1992. You're a medical student. You become a resident. It's 2005. And that's when sorafenib, I think it was sorafenib as a cytokine failure option, came out, and then sunitinib as first line in 2006. So how did that kind of change the game?
Yeah. So again, we go from something where patients are often need to be admitted to get to now something that they can take at home. There was incredible excitement. Remember, we're still dealing with some pretty toxic medicines, right? So sunitinib was designed as 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off, right? So we knew that it was really tough to take for long periods of time without a break.
Right. And that was a daily pill.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
So that oral med, but from, it's very approval was 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So not something where you're just going to take every day for months or years. We knew that we had by the end of this 4 weeks, people are going to be feeling a little bit rough. We'd give them a little bit of break and then get back on drug. Mm-hmm. But again, allowed people to be treated at home, allowed people to, many people could still continue to be able to work, do other activities that were important to them. You're not being admitted. The travel burden. So having a few places across the country that were very skilled in giving IL-2, where now oncologists all over the place would be able to prescribe.
Oh, interesting.
Nintedanib. So, you know, in terms of access to care, went up a lot.
Oh, I didn't realize there were like IL-2 like centers.
Well, I mean, there were certainly, you know, centers just like there are comprehensive cancer centers. Yeah. There were places that were really, really skilled with it and you do a lot. And that's the kind of therapy you don't necessarily want somebody who never does it to try to do it. Again, because of all the supportive care and other resources that are needed to do it well. So you had sort of, I think, you know, different places that had a real skill set in it. But you can imagine if you're 300 miles away from the best place close to do it is a very different proposition than, you know, saying, yeah, I can go within my county to an oncology center that's going to allow me to get an oral medication.
So we frame this by thinking IL-2 complete response rate is 7%, and these drugs come along and they're slightly worse than that, correct? Is that
kind of you think? They never really had the huge, you know, they never exceeded a complete response rate of that.
Okay. They're better tolerated, so overall survival improves because people aren't like dying as much from the treatment itself.
Right. So again, we're trying to shift this. Again, ideally, we can get cure. If we can't get cure, can we get stable disease or, you know, some kind of partial response, you know, really by RECIST criteria? But I would say mostly when I'm talking about patients, it's either, you know, are things getting smaller or staying the same, which is good, or are things growing or worse, new things showing up? Mm-hmm. So again, that's what we're looking to do. But unfortunately, even in the, you know, the TKI monotherapy area, you know, the vast majority of patients are still ultimately dying of their disease. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of work left to do, but again, another really important tool for oncologists to have with the TKIs.
Mm-hmm. So then at around, I'd say maybe, I guess, a couple of years later, that's when we start getting our mTOR inhibitors. So those come onto the scene. And how do those compare to the TKIs?
Yeah, I've never been sort of as enthusiastic as some of the mTOR things. So now we're 2007, 2009. You know, again, it was another class of medicines that we did not have. So we went from nothing to cytokines to now we have TKIs, and we now have two types of TKIs. So targeting VEGF and the VEGF receptor with bevacizumab, and now we also have mTOR. So great. We've got more options if someone's not responding to a VEGF, which is now very straightforward to say, okay, we're now going to try an mTOR inhibitor as a second line therapy. So giving people options, again, like we talked about, there are some folks who would have some pretty significant toxicities to the VEGF inhibitors. So, okay, great. We can now have a second option. So either because of lack of ability to for us to adequately manage side effects, so toxicity driving a change, or because of disease progression, we were able to switch to a different mechanism.
So, like, for the most part in this period of time, sunitinib is like your first line therapy gold standard.
Yeah, I would say so. Again, they, you know, sunitinib 2006. Again, the sorafenib was really first approved for cytokine, you know, progression on cytokines. So, you know, really we had sunitinib for 2006 and then temsirolimus and then everolimus weren't really approved for another couple of years. So sunitinib really had that sort of running room to really become well-established in the community because it was the first TKI for first line clear cell RCC that was approved. And, you know, just important to mention, all these are really talking about clear cell renal cell carcinoma.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Whether you call it non-clear cell renal cell carcinoma or variant histologies, there's a couple different labels to it, but essentially everything that's not clear cell, we still have a real extremely limited number of options for that.
So that's the kind of 2000s, and then we get into the 2010s, and the trend that I see in the 2010s is all these approvals for second line therapies. And this is probably like very obvious and it goes without saying, but I feel like I should say it just because, you know, maybe putting it into words is helpful. There's like always this trend in how clinical trials end up happening in cancer. You end up kind of treating your, you end up looking at these drugs, usually first line metastatic setting, and then second line to kind of try to help tell you how to order things potentially in the metastatic setting or what to follow after treatment failure. And then you start designing clinical trials looking at maybe neoadjuvant or adjuvant. Could you talk a little bit about that and how clinical trials generally tend to progress?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it depends on what you're studying, right? So for many of these agents we're talking about, they were in the same class or same family as sunitinib. And so they would often say, okay, is this something that we can use in a second or third line setting? And then we'll see if we can gradually move it up.
Okay.
And so something that's also really important for us to just comment on is to think not only about the agent, the thing that's being tested, but what is it being compared to?
Right.
And so remember, up until now, we're talking really predominantly placebo-controlled studies. Which is, okay, you can do a placebo-controlled study in cancer. There are some specific criteria you need to meet, you know, one of them being that there's not an accepted standard of care. So that's how they sort of started with the kidney cancer. We're like, well, IL-2 is so toxic. We'll just, you know, say that because it's highly toxic and doesn't have an incredibly great response rate. I mean, again, that 7% CR, they were able to use a lot of this as, you know, placebo. So sorafenib was against placebo. Sunitinib was against interferon alpha. Temsirolimus was against interferon alpha. So again, sort of using what we had with the cytokines. And then as we're moving on and getting new things, they would often come in, okay, let's look at the second line and see where you go. I think depending if you're going with an entirely new class of drugs or new type of therapy, like we eventually got to with the, you know, eventually when we jump ahead to our checkpoint inhibitors, you know, eventually they were being tested first class, first line and being compared to sunitinib. So first, what was the first line TKI? So I would say it really depends, you know, is it in the same class? You're often going to start later, subsequent line, and then see if you can move up. If you're doing something completely new and a new pathway, a new type of therapy, you can then sort of go head to head, first line versus first line. A lot of it is you know, sort of figuring out where the needs are and what's happening.
And a lot of these like TKIs, for example, like they usually target, you know, Yox tyrosine kinases, but there's some that target just VEGF, some that target multiple. And so they're slightly different mechanisms. So it kind of makes sense to try one if they failed on the other.
Back then, exactly. So back then, we're looking at, you know, if you started on a VEGF TKI and you had progression, then go to an mTOR inhibitor, vice versa.
So if I come in with like metastatic kidney cancer in 2011, I'm probably getting sunitinib to start, and then maybe I'm being advanced to one of the second line, like pazopanib or bevacizumab, like something like that, or one of the everolimuses potentially.
Yes, that would make a lot of sense. You know, first line, people are going to choose what they're comfortable with. So again, it would be a lot of sunitinib. would be my guess. Pazopanib again became a popular choice in 2009 because it still had that VEGF predominant targeting, but was better tolerated than sunitinib. So again, that was something that was given orally every day instead of like the 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off. So I would say, you know, pazopanib really started to expand, just again, efficacy and toxicity. And then as things continued to go, you would again have these choice of second line agents. But then that would sort of then push us into, you know, shortly thereafter, you know, really 2015, we're looking at nivolumab and then ipi-nivo in 2018. And that's really the next important chapter.
Yeah, I want to jump to that chapter. But yeah, before we do, let's talk about cytoreductive nephrectomy.
Sure. One of my favorite things to
talk about. Exactly. What got you into it in the first place while you're here? Because so it's an interferon alpha, it's a cytokine era, and my studies are showing that cytoreductive nephrectomy is helpful. It improves survival. Now we're in the TKI era. What are the big studies that are being done, and what are they showing about cytoreductive nephrectomy?
Yeah, so still showing a benefit for patients who had cytoreduction and then were getting systemic therapy. So pick your TKI of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The things then got kind of complicated. So we're trucking along, cytoreduction, that's great. And then we did sort of Carmina and Sertime. And the Carmina study specifically was just saying, well, since we've got TKIs and they're pretty good, do we even need to do the surgery anymore? Or should we just do systemic therapy only and ignore the primary versus doing surgery and then giving additional systemic therapy? I was not as swayed by Carmina as some others. I mean, it was a study that took a long time to accrue. There were very few patients enrolled at each center. And so as you know, for complex surgical things, you want to go to a high volume center with high volume surgeons because they are going to have, you know, better outcomes.
Got it.
So I wasn't really as dour on the idea of changing cytoreductive nephrectomy. What I do think it helped us clarify is really being thoughtful about who we're offering surgery to, right? So there's a concern for optimism bias, right? Like I'm a surgeon, I fix things through surgery. You've got a really bad problem. You're hoping for something to help make your problem better. Let's team up and let me do a big surgery on you. For many patients, that might be a great idea, but there are certainly some patients where it may not. So being really thoughtful about performance status, burden of cancer, so how much kidney cancer is in the kidney versus in distant spots. Where are those distant spots? So lung, adrenal, pancreas versus brain, bone, liver.
On the
difference. Again, performance status, nutrition, you get into the Motzer criteria and then the Heng criteria through IMDC. So are people severe? Are they anemic? Are they hypercalcemic? You know, what's going on sort of systemically to get a sense? Is this someone who would tolerate a big operation, but an operation that in itself will not be curative?
Right.
It's cytoreduction. So it's reducing the volume that these medicines will have to work, you know, the tumor burden, the tumor volume that the medicines will have to work against, but it's not going to be curative in itself.
Right.
That's where I think Carmina really helped us refocus and be thinking, all right, who should we be operating on? And has now sort of gotten us into the idea, which is becoming much more popular, is the idea of deferred cytoreductive.
Because that's interesting, because Carmina, just to summarize, Carmina looked at, you know, upfront cytoreductive nephrectomy, correct? Is that, am I right?
Yep.
Versus plus interferon alpha or pusudentinib versus sudentinib alone, and showed a benefit with that risk, that good risk group specifically, which is what you're talking about with these risk criteria that start becoming important. The patients that are, you know, low risk, meaning like less metastatic sites, like you're saying, good performance status. And then SirTime was really that question of upfront versus deferred cytoreductive nephrectomy. So everyone got their cytoreductive nephrectomy, but it was just the timing thing. And I thought that within the sunitinib era, that showed maybe a more of a benefit with the deferred deferred, or which one? Sorry, I can't remember.
Well, so again, it's talking about which sort of risk group you fall in.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we just completed a study, Mark Stein, a great colleague and friend at Columbia and GU Medical Oncology, with Carrie Runcie there as well. And it was Columbia, Rutgers, Cleveland Clinic, and Ohio State, as we were doing the Cytokick trial. So metastatic clear cell kidney cancer using combination therapy. So nivolumab plus cabozantinib. So a checkpoint inhibitor plus a multi-kinase TKI. They would get 3 months of systemic therapy first, then cytoreduction, then more systemic therapy. And so I think we're sort of getting the idea that treating patients up front can potentially help us change some of these risk factors. So like Ari Hakimi at Sloan Kettering, he did a great paper in Cancer a few years ago. He was just looking at surgery, but he found that some patients, you would actually be able to modify their IMDC risk score by doing surgery. You do a nephrectomy and now their anemia is getting better. Their hypercalcemia is resolving. So,
This makes things more complicated.
It does, but it also makes things exciting because it shows that some of these risk factors and some of these sort of rubrics or scoring systems we use can actually be malleable.
Yeah.
So that's really exciting for us because we can say, all right, this person's really sick. We're not sure what to do. Yes, they are surgically resectable, but there's a lot of other things that make them high risk for surgery. Let's go ahead and treat them systemically up front. Let's see how they're responding to that. Let's see if we can improve their nutrition. You know, just like we've done in the cystectomy space, where we're talking about immunonutrition, we're talking about prehab, we're addressing and trying to modify
things
that are going to make a large surgery more likely to be successful and less likely to be morbid. And I think that's really exciting. We can then again do surgery and then potentially get people back on drug. One of my partners here, Sean Dason, you know, he's done some work in this, looking at some large databases, again, showing that doing cytoreductive surgery after upfront immunotherapy and targeted therapy does not change the safety profile of the surgery. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
The neoadjuvant therapy is not making surgery a more risky enterprise, and showing that some patients are doing better. But really, like you were saying, this is still largely a patient selection conundrum.
So that's cytoreductive nephrectomy in the TKI era. And then we wanted to talk about the next chapter, the most exciting chapter, the chapter we are in now, which is largely referred to as either the ICI chapter or the immuno-oncology chapter. And this really kind of starts in 2018 with nivolumab and ipilimumab. So let's talk a little bit about these drugs that start coming out around that time.
Yeah, so Nivo was, I think, approved as a second line in 2015. And then we had the great combo of ipi-nivo in 2018 as a first line therapy, and, you know, really changing things quite a bit. So we start to see, like ipi-nivo, for example, they're both intravenous drugs working through two different pathways that regulate the immune system. So essentially taking the brakes off the immune system to allow the body to better identify tumor and go after it and destroy it. Fantastic work, resulted in Nobel Prizes, Dr. Jim Allison and colleagues at MD Anderson. So really exciting work, not to you know, got to give a shout out to Dr. Kalin for his VEGF work, which was also a Nobel Prize. So it's very exciting that kidney cancer researchers have received two Nobel Prizes in the very recent history. So for all the aspiring surgeon scientists, physician scientists out there, kidney cancer is a great place to go.
I didn't realize that we had two Nobelists. Wow, that's so really exciting.
So exciting stuff there. So we have those combos starting to see complete response rates rise again. So
really,
things are now starting to exceed the historic standard of, you know, about 7% set by high dose IL-2. We're now seeing things 8, 9, even up to 10%.
I think it was CheckMate 214, that's ipi-nivo. So that's the one we're talking about. And that was around 9%, I think, was the complete response rate, which is pretty good.
I believe Len-Pem set the benchmark at like 10 or 11 or something like that. But I forget the exact number. But again, you're talking 10%, 1 in 10. I mean, if I had a 10% chance to win the lottery, I'd play.
Correct. Exactly.
So we're really opening up some new options. For our patients. And then, like you said previously, we then have additionally second and even third line approved therapies for patients. So we've got a lot of options, and sort of the duration and number of lines of therapy people can receive has increased as well.
So it was for trainees to kind of picture this in their head, starting in like the 90s, we have this one drug that if it works for you, if you get a complete response, great. Otherwise, very toxic. Things kind of creep along. You start getting some TKIs. That kind of was almost a 20-hour period of just kind of figuring out TKIs and mTORs. And then all of a sudden, 2018, and suddenly there's this rapid development of all these different doublet therapy regimens, starting with ipi-nivo, going to axi-pembro in the KEYNOTE-426. And then I think Javelin Renal 101, that was axi and avelumab. That wasn't, I don't think that reached significance to be FDA approved.
Correct.
Right. So what do you think in your mind? In your mind, you're like, okay, there's four regimens, right? That you consider for first line therapy for kidney cancer today. What are those?
Right. So, well, again, you know, so I'll refer people to the ASCO guideline that came out a couple of years ago, which again, it's a little bit more nuanced because we're looking at people, you know, sort of favorable, intermediate, poor risk by IMDC. So that plays into it. But in terms of doublet regimens that we're talking about, we've got ipi-nivo, pembro, axitinib, avelumab, axitinib, nivo, cabo, and len-pem, lenvatinib, pembrolizumab. So, I think for a lot of these, often it comes down to sort of what are providers comfortable with. Right. So remember that the vast majority of cancer care is provided in the community, and so how many different regimens is each provider going to become very comfortable with? Some of these also may be impacted by patients' insurance. So it gets really complicated. Like, all right, does their pharmacy benefit manager company have a different tiering for this combo versus this combo? Things you didn't think you'd have to think about in medical school, but toxicity can be very real. But I would say that it is often sort of ipi-nivo as one choice, or you're talking about an IO-TKI combination.
Got it.
And for that, a lot of it comes down to, again, sort of what are patient goals? And I would say that ipi-nivo probably has a slightly higher complete response rate, but may take longer for you to see those responses. You're looking for something based on tumor location or size, adjacent anatomy, and you need, or symptomology, and you need something that may be a faster response to therapy, then things like lenvatinib pembrolizumab or nivo cabo might be a more reasonable choice, because you're getting that TKI presumably to act a little bit faster. So you're going to be able to see some of that tumor shrinkage, or ideally some, you know, improvement in some of these parameters we were talking about, appetite, energy, performance status, reduced pain, mm-hmm. things like
that. And I think I know that nevo-ipi is kind of one of the more commonly used ones in the first line setting, but, you know, we've already touched on this a little bit. All of these regimens have been compared against sunitinib. So we don't really have like high quality data pitting them, you know, comparing them against each other.
Right. So largely sort of the critique of the first set of drugs, so all of our TKIs were either against interferon or placebo, or now we have all these later drugs and they're sort of against sunitinib, which we've already said is probably not anyone's choice. If you had to pick a single, you know, a monotherapy TKI, no one's going to reach back and grab sunitinib.
Got it.
So it is unfortunate. It's like, all right, we're not even using pazopanib as comparator. So we end up running into some of the history of these and saying, well, it's not surprising that something like, you know, a combination therapy is going to be better than an mTOR inhibitor. Like, okay, you know, that's true. You are using an FDA-approved comparator as your standard, but it's a standard that nobody would really
use anymore.
Be super excited to say, yeah, I think that's going to you know, carry the day.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. And we need to be really more thoughtful, I think, when we're choosing our comparators to make sure that it's really going to be very informative, no matter which way the you know, whether successful or unsuccessful of the study, that we need to make sure we're learning something.
Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to me that, you know, if doublet therapy is great, you know, wouldn't more drugs be better? Like, what about
treatment? Absolutely. If some is good, more and newer have to be better. I totally get where you're going. And I think you're bringing up the idea of Cosmic 313. Great study. So if we have ipi-nevo approved, and if we have nevo-cabo approved, why don't we do ipi-nevo-cabo? And that was a great study. I was very excited for it, but it was a bit surprising. So again, when we're trying to combine drugs, what we're really hoping for is synergy.
Yeah.
So you've got A plus B doesn't just get you C, it gets you F.
Got it.
And so we're hoping for synergy and efficacy, but only minimal additive toxicity, right? Because the more drug you give people, the more side effects there are going to be, because each of those drugs is going to have some different things it's going to impact. Unfortunately, with that combination, I think we saw, we didn't see the efficacy that we were looking for. We didn't see, you know, complete response rates of 15 or 20%, something that would have been really awesome. We didn't see a complete response rate that was really incredibly, really markedly better than the doublets of either of those alone. And not surprisingly, toxicity was higher.
Right.
So in an update to that ASCO guideline I mentioned earlier, there was a rapid update that we did and sort of cautioned that if you're thinking about doing triplet therapy, we really still need to do that on a trial.
Gotcha.
So I don't think that the triple therapy was, didn't meet its mark. And again, I think that's the important part about trials. Like, so we all saw the trial, Cosmic 313. I'm like, this is a great idea, but it's important that we just don't run off and start adopting the regimen before we have the data.
Uh-huh.
If I just let my bias say, hey, I think this is going to be better, I don't really have the data to support it, but I'm going to be treating people with it, I'm not accruing to the trial, so I'm not helping us answer the question, and I'm exposing patients to risk with unknown, unclear benefit. And in this case, it turned out to not be a better therapeutic.
Right.
I think that's really important for us to sort of retain that intellectual honesty when we're thinking about trials. And if you want to offer that therapy, great, offer it on trial. Don't just copy the trial and do it independently.
Yeah.
Because we're not getting the knowledge. patients are not getting followed as closely as they would need to be if they were on trial, and we're delaying getting that better answer. And we've seen that several times in the history of medicine and oncology, where what we all thought was going to be a great idea turned out to not quite be the case.
Right, right.
So that study brings up a lot of important lessons for us.
Yeah, and that was recently, I think. That was a couple of years ago that was published, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so
2023, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, the ASCO update, yeah, that came out, I think, 23.
Okay. And that was maybe 2022.
Yeah, so it was, again, a recent thing, and it was a great study design, great questions. Unfortunately, we just didn't quite, you know, get the improvement without the toxicity we were looking for.
So I feel like you've taken us on a journey. I've been through the entire history of kidney cancer. What's next? What are the trials that are coming out that you're excited about?
Yeah. Well, something we didn't necessarily touch on too much was the whole idea of adjuvant therapy.
Right. That's like a whole other can of worms.
Right, right, right. So KEYNOTE-564 adjuvant pembrolizumab showed both a benefit in terms of recurrence-free survival, so less cancer came back, and overall survival, people who took the drug lived longer. Of course, these benefits are small, but real. But there are some toxicities that can be severe and can be permanent. So I think one of the things that we're wrestling right now, certainly within urologic oncology, is who are the patients that really would be best served by adjuvant therapy?
Mm-hmm.
Because by definition, with adjuvant, we're going to be overtreating, right? There's no evidence of disease radiographically. So we're just saying, okay, your pathology said this, therefore we think you're at high enough risk for us to consider giving you this drug. So I think us coming up with better biomarkers, like you've written about, and sort of saying, okay, how can we better figure out who are the people are at highest risk of recurrence, who are the people at highest risk of toxicity? So if for some reason there's a subset of patients that we can identify a molecular signature or some other factors to say, oh, wow, you are really at risk for immune-related adverse events, that might temper our enthusiasm to give someone an adjuvant or an adjuvant immunotherapy.
Right.
I think also one of the things that's coming up now is, like we talked about with cytoreductive surgery, is the idea of sequencing. So are we going to give people drug ahead of time, so neoadjuvant or preoperative, then do surgery, and then do adjuvant or postoperative therapy? I think that's a space that is going to continue to evolve. But in both of those scenarios, I think it's really critical that our urologists and urologic oncologists are really in the center of those discussions and being deeply involved with the trials. Because we are the patients, we are the people who are seeing those patients doing the surgery. And as Dr. Linehan from the NCI says, you know, who knows kidney cancer better than urologists?
Right, right.
That's our thing. So, I think it's critical for our future urologic oncologists to really be involved with kidney cancer from diagnosis through systemic therapies. Mm-hmm. And I think the perioperative as well as adjuvant spaces are a great example of that.
And, you know, understanding the therapies that are available in the metastatic setting gives you the kind of context to understand the conversations that are happening with perioperative trials, because they're a lot of the same drugs. You're just buying either monotherapy or, you know, you're trying them in different dosages depending on like before or after. And I think that, you know, you can understand better what's happening once you know, like, the names, if the names of the drugs are familiar to you.
Yeah. And also, you know, again, helps with counseling patients. And so also patients with oligometastatic disease, oligorecurrent disease, oligoprogressive disease. So they may have multiple sites, but there's only one or two that are growing. How are we going to manage that? Surgery can still play an important role in each of those disease states. So like you were saying, I think it's really critical that patients have a kidney cancer team. And so it's not just one or the other, but we have our patient at the center We have our urologic oncologist, our medical oncologist, and then as needed, interventional radiology, radiation oncology, genetics, palliative medicine, you know, all these great providers who are able to sort of wrap that patient in the 360 degrees of care that they need to manage them through this entire kidney cancer journey from diagnosis through therapy.
Yeah, it takes a village to kill a tumor.
Right. But as Dr. Linehan says, in 2025, the best drug we have against kidney cancer is still formalin.
So. Oh my gosh. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I did want to briefly just touch on belzutifan, which is kind of a first in class drug that is not approved like widely for kidney cancer, but has a very specific indication in patients with VHL, but is being studied kind of, you know, for other things. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So instead of targeting VEGF, this is a HIF inhibitor. So
kind of like earlier in the.
Yeah. So super important drug, amazing basic and translational science that has gone into developing that. So super exciting. Oral agent. The big toxicities with that are anemia and hypoxia. So not surprising, you're messing with hypoxia inducible factor. First came or was original target population was really patients with VHL. So von Hippel-Lindau, loss of chromosome 3P, so hereditary kidney cancer syndrome, bilateral multifocal clear cell renal cell carcinoma, as well as pheochromocytomas, whole litany of other affected eye, CNS, you know, and these HIF inhibitors have been effective against all those areas. So it's not just improving
right
tumors, but also the other sequelae
of
VHL. So we are seeing HIF inhibitors now being studied in combination with other drugs in the perioperative and adjuvant space as well. So again, saying we're doing TKI IO combinations, should we be doing HIF inhibitor IO combinations? And so that's an area with a lot of studies going on right now.
Okay. Anything else that you want to add before we wrap up?
Oh, well, sure. I'll give an unsolicited plug for urologic oncology as a field.
Great.
Yes. So great area to be in. Fantastic people. I love that our oncology fellows are really able to gain great disease expertise. So while we use lots of different cool techniques and technologies to treat cancer, our practice is not defined by them.
Uh-huh.
So the one thing I know for certain is that therapies are going to continue to evolve. Technology is going to continue to evolve. And so for me, I want my career to be defined by having content expertise.
Right.
Ease or an illness, and then I'm going to use that expertise, whether it's surveillance, biopsy, ablation, surgery, systemic therapies, combination treatments with other specialists, to get the patient the best opportunity for them to achieve the goals they're looking for, rather than having my practice really be defined by something that I use or do. So that's sort of my unsolicited why SUO makes a difference. Certainly, I think kidney cancer is such an amazing space to be working in. It's just a great group of collaborators, investigators, and it's so inspiring to see our patients and their families and caregivers give so much to help participate in our trials to try to move the field forward. So it's incredibly, incredibly inspiring group of people to work with.
And it's ever changing. You're never going to get bored. That's for sure.
Yeah. I think I still fall into the mid-career category, despite my hairline, mid-career. And as you've seen from this brief talk, things have changed a lot just a few decades from when I was in medical school. And I, you know, really anticipate the pace of change to continue and for things to get even better. You know, we didn't even touch on, like you said, biomarkers, which you've written on, role of functional imaging and nuclear medicine and diagnostics, theranostics. So lots and lots of exciting things on the forefront for kidney cancer.
Well, I guess I'll just have to have you back. You could be a repeat guest.
I'd love it. Let's see if anyone other than my mother watches this first, and then
once we go viral and become internet famous, we can discuss the terms of your interview status.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Singer. Have a great rest of your day.
Dr. Goodstein, always great to see you. Thanks so much for the invite. You've got the great work.
Thank you.